Hello once again, and thank you so much for tuning in. This is Behind the Book. On this episode of the Behind the Book podcast, we will have the great pleasure to be joined by award-winning screenwriter, journalist, documentary producer, and author, Glenn Craney, to discuss his new novel, The Fire and the Light. Among his many accomplishments, Glenn was awarded the Nickel Fellowship Prize by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for outstanding screenwriting for his script, Whisper the Wind, about the Native American Indians and their language. In his new novel, which is set in the early 13th century when the Christian world is roiled by massive spiritual upheaval, he tells the tale of Esclarmonde du Foix, the Cathars, and the lost teachings of Christ. It's my pleasure to be now joined by Glenn Craney from his home up in Malibu. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Ron. How are you doing?
Excellent. So, with all of your background, it's interesting to me to find out what inspired you to write this novel about esoteric mystery and intrigue in medieval France.
You know, as far-fetched as it sounds, Ron, the story found me several years ago one night. I was awakened by a dream of a robed priestess who was walking around the ruins of a mountain castle. And the word crusade kept repeating in my ear. And around her feet sprouted strange crosses. Now, these were no ordinary crosses. They shifted between having two and three horizontal beams. And this priestess was bathed in a dazzling sunlight. She walked toward me with her arms open and said, "Peace, child, let the light." And then the dream ended. Well, needless to say, I was flabbergasted by this. The next morning, I was launched on a detective quest that was worthy of the Da Vinci Code, really.
And how difficult was it to research this story? I mean, it took place over 800 years ago. Where did you begin?
I basically just went to the library and started looking up anything I could about these crosses that I could find. I discovered that the triple cross, the one with the three bars, was adopted by the medieval papacy back in the Middle Ages for reasons that still remain shrouded in mystery. There's an esoteric classic written by an anonymous French author called The Meditations on the Tarot. And this book says that the triple cross symbolizes the respiration between the angelic and earthly realms. The one who carries this cross is deemed to be the gatekeeper of spiritual ascent and descent. Well, needless to say, that intrigued me. My next step was to find out about the double cross. And I learned that this was called the Cross of Lorraine back during the Crusades. It was the cross first used by the Knights Templar and the Christian armies in the Holy Land. This double cross has had quite a history. It was adopted by the French resistance during the World War II in their fight against the Nazis. And today, if you go travel around southwestern France, you'll still see this cross etched in graffiti on bridges and rocks, and it's a symbol of what's called the Occitan movement. There used to be an old region in France known as Occitania, and there's still people to try to promote the independence of this region again from the government in France.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the Cathar Cross in a second, but you were intrigued in this story enough to go to southern France, and you explored all the Cathar castles there. What was that experience like, and is there one key thing that you learned when you went there?
After a few months of doing the research in the libraries as much as I could, I realized that I really had to go to these spots and find out more myself. One of the first places I went was a haunting, they call it a pog. It's really a small mountain in the foothills of the Pyrenees called Mont Ségur. And that in Occitan means the Mount of Salvation. And there's still ruins of a castle on top of this small mountain. Quite a difficult climb. I managed to make it one afternoon. And I suddenly realized that the terrain I was looking at was very much like the terrain I had seen in my dream. So that led me to research more about Mont Ségur. I found out that it was known as the Cathar headquarters, where these people who were Christian pacifists, really, they were some of the first reformers of the church, had held out in a siege back in 1244. And we'll, of course, I'm sure get into what happened to them later, but it was at this spot, Mont Ségur, that I first realized that this was the terrain that was in my dream.
You also mentioned in your book that these crosses that appeared to you in your dream alternated between having two and three traverse beams. Were you ever able to determine, you know, what that meant in your dream, this changing aspect of the crosses and what it meant?
Yeah, I think, Ron, that these dreams seem to come in very compressed symbols. And I think what I was being led to learn was that the Cathars had a connection to this ongoing struggle for freedom in France that has been going on for centuries. I came across a book by a now deceased scholar of ancient religions. Her name was Norma Laura Goodrich. She was, in fact, a professor at Claremont College here in California. And she'd written a book called The Holy Grail. And I was talking to her one day during this process about a documentary that I was doing. And thumbing through her book, I suddenly came across the triple cross that she had identified in her book as the Catharist cross. It was a medieval watermark that was used by these Cathars in southern France. And I realized then that this going the symbols in my dream, going from the double to the triple crosses back and forth, I was being told that the Cathars were an important element of this ongoing fight for freedom in France. And that fight for freedom has been symbolized even up to today by the Cross of Lorraine, which is the double cross.
Yeah, and also it's been used in ways to influence people in a broad range.
Right, sure.
In broad way. Do you, you know, along those same lines, you know, this is kind of a direct question, but do you think the Vatican and, you know, Catholicism stole the Catholic cross?
I don't have any direct evidence of that, but it's very intriguing that the origins of this cross go back to about the time when the Cathars supposedly used it as their symbol. There is a lot about this story that we don't know because so much of the evidence, at least from the Cathar perspective, was destroyed. This was the time when the Inquisition was instituted. A lot of people think, wrongly assume, that the Inquisition started in Spain a couple centuries later with Isabella and Ferdinand and Torquemada. In fact, the first Inquisition took place during this time in the 13th century in southern France, and it was directed against these people called the Cathars. And so there is a lot of suspicion, a lot of conjecture, that a lot of what the Cathars knew and protected, the church wanted. Either they wanted it for themselves or they wanted it suppressed.
Do you have an opinion or have you come to some conclusion about why this Cathar princess appeared to you in a dream?
You know, Rana, that's a question I've asked myself repeatedly. Why was I chosen to tell this story, to tell the story of her life? I can only tell you this, that as I went back to France, I've been back a couple times to what's called Cathar country, and it's if you ever get a chance, go back, because this is one of the most remarkable places in the world that I've been to. These ruins of these castles that sit up on top of these foothills of the Pyrenees. As I went back there, I had what I can only term as kind of deja vu experience. I felt like I had come home, that I had been there before. So, you know, the Cathars themselves believed in reincarnation, and there has been a long history of researchers who have come up with studies of people who claim that they had lived at the time of the Cathars and they were returning to talk about their experiences. You know, there's a sense for me, I guess, that this story requires somebody to give testimony of what happened. So I guess the second thing is I'm struck by some of the similarities to what's happening today in terms of religious terrorism, religious fundamentalism, and what happened during the 13th century in France. If you want to get an idea of what it was, the Inquisition was like in the war against the Cathars, which was called the Albigensian Crusade, all you have to do is look today towards what the Taliban regime in Afghanistan was like, or even the Chinese oppression of the Tibetans in China. It's very similar. So I guess the bottom line is, I think there's a message this priestess, Esperon de Foix, was bringing to today in terms of warning about the effects of religious terror, religious fundamentalism, and most importantly, for those who assume that it can West to Christianity. This story will open their eyes.
And can you talk a little bit about your main character, Esclarmonde de Foix? Why did you decide to write this book as a novel as opposed to nonfiction history or more of a documentary eye?
Sure. There have been several traditional histories done on the Cathars, but all of them, to me, seem to be deficient. In one regard is that so much of the evidence of what happened, we really don't have anymore, at least from the Cathar perspective. There's a noted historian named Zoe Oldenburg, who wrote what I think is probably the definitive history on the story. It's called Massacre at Mont Secours. And she says in that book that if we had a chronicler, someone who could have told the story from the Cathar perspective back at that time, we'd have a radically different view of what happened. So in this sense, I was presented both with a problem and an opportunity. As a novelist, I had leeway, because there were such gaps in the history, of trying to fill the gaps with suppositions, with conjectures, with at least trying to stay with history as I knew it, but giving my perspective or my supposition of what could have happened. Now, some people, this is why the Cathars, I think, today are so intriguing to people, is that because there's so much about them that we really don't know. And so for a novelist, this is, like I say, both a boon and an obstacle. And I chose to write it as a novel so that I could move beyond being tied down to what little resources we have in the area.
And there's a controversial theme in the novel, which touches on the role that St. Dominic played in the church's massacre of the Cathars. Did you intend to be a whistleblower of sorts, or do you have any qualms about exposing some of the darker sides of the history behind Catholicism and the church?
You know, I was raised in the Roman Catholic faith, and of course, I had always heard of St. Dominic. He was the inventor, if you will, of the rosary. The story goes that, and this all occurred at this time, the story goes that the Virgin Mary appeared to him and told him to create the rosary out of roses that she drew out of her mouth and handed to him. So St. Dominic, to me, you know, he's the founder of the Dominican order and so forth. I had never heard the real story of the role that he played in the Albigensian Crusade, and quite frankly, I was shocked the more I learned about it. He came from a military family from Castile in Spain, and he approached the mission against the Cathars, which is what it was called at that time. The church first tried to convince the Cathars to come back to the orthodoxy of the church. He approached that as a military operation, and when they held public debates that Esclarmonde herself engaged in, very famous debates with Dominic himself. But when Dominic failed to persuade the people of Aquitania to his point of view, he threatened them by saying, "You will suffer the rod of the church," which in effect meant he was telling them that war was coming. 40 years of brutal war. He followed the armies. He was there fanning the flames. And, I was in Spain a few years ago, and I had the chance to visit his hometown. It's a little village of Calaruga. And there's a museum there that the Dominicans maintained. I walked in that day, and there was a wonderful little nun. I think she was from South America. She allowed me to walk through the museum and see all the exhibits. Not one word about Dominic and his role during the Albigensian Crusade. I was tempted to ask her about it, but I didn't want to disturb her view of what the man was like. But I think this is one of the characters in the story that people will, they'll be surprised to find out his true role.
I just find that story fascinating. You also have something that's interesting to me in the book that play a fascinating role in the story, and that's the Knights of Templar. Were the Templars involved in the Cathars in a conspiracy to overthrow the church? Did you find anything like that in your research?
Well, this is another controversial subject. The Templars are another very hot topic right now. There's been a lot of books about them. They were created by the church to ostensibly protect pilgrims who were on their way to the Holy Land during the Crusades. Eventually, they became a fierce fighting force as the Crusades receded and Holy Land was lost to the Church, the Templars really had no role at this point. So they converted themselves into really what they became the bankers of the first bankers of the world. And they became so powerful in terms of the wealth that they accumulated that they were rivals to kings and church. And this is a little side note. Friday the 13th came about, the suspicion of that date came about because that was the day that the church and the king of France rounded up all the Templars and had them thrown into prison and eventually executed. Now, they were very prominent in southern France at this time, and their connection to the Cathars has been suggested as this. Both may have encountered evidence of a teachings of Christ that were contrary to what the church was teaching at the time. The Templars were in the Holy Land. It is thought that they may have come upon alternate teachings of early Christian groups. In fact, there have been some of those texts found in the last century, the Gnostic Gospels and the Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth. So the question is, did the Templars find similar type of texts? And did they share them with the Cathars? We don't know for sure.
You talk at the end of the book in your author's notes, it's been pretty well documented that Hitler and the Nazi Party were fascinated by everything religious, all kinds of religious icons, and they were particularly interested in the Cathars. What did you find out about that obsession in your research?
Well, this is another aspect that was stunning to me. There's an old saying in esoteric circles that the darkness always seeks out the light, and you could not find two more different groups than the Cathars and the Nazis. The Cathars were pacifist, vegetarian. They were Gnostic leaning, and that by that I mean that they believed in the individual quest towards truth. They meditated to a light, spiritual light. The Nazis, of course, were everything that was not. They were hierarchical, but they attempted to. They were obsessed with the Holy Grail. They came to believe that the Cathars had possessed the Holy Grail during the Middle Ages. And there was a German poet, mystic archaeologist named Otto Rahn back in the 1920s, who was so convinced that Montségur and the area around the Ariège region of France was the receptacle of the Holy Grail that he set up a base there and did what he called archaeological searches. Now, it wasn't traditionally what we would call archaeology today. I mean, he searched caves and caverns and so forth around there, and came back with reports that he had found graffiti. He had found strange altars in caverns that looked like they were Cathar chapels. He had even found skeletons set up in what looked like it may have been a ritualistic form of sun worship. All of this, of course, has never been confirmed by later archaeologists, but it's enough to give researchers enough of a spur to go forward and try to find what Otto Rahn and some of these other Cathar researchers claim they have found.
You just mentioned the Holy Grail, and recently, with the success of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, there's been so much speculation out there about the Holy Grail. Do you have an opinion about what the Holy Grail actually was?
Boy, you open up a can of worms with this one, Ron. I applaud Dan Brown for what he did with the Da Vinci Code. He brought a topic into the public awareness that I think is very important. He made people eager to look at alternative possibilities and explanations of early Christianity. But I don't agree with his conclusions about the Holy Grail being a bloodline, a royal Jewish lineage that came from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. At least as for the Cathars, this would have been something they wouldn't have been concerned about. The Cathars were much more focused upon finding their way back to what they called their spiritual home, the light. And material concerns about a bloodline or anything to do with the body or family relations it simply would not have been part of their theology. So if in fact they were connected to the Holy Grail, what I suspect it was perhaps knowledge of early Christianity that was at odds with what the church was teaching. Could have also included ancient scrolls that came from the earliest Christians, followers of perhaps James, the brother of Jesus in Jerusalem, that escaped. There was a group, a division, if you will, back in these earliest times of Christianity between Paul and some of the Jewish Christians that had been followers of Jesus. Some historians suspect that the Cathars may have been inheritors of this knowledge, gnosis is what they call it, of these earliest Christians, and that it was contrary to perhaps the line of thinking, of theology that Paul and Peter and eventually Rome developed.
Fascinating stuff. Back to the book. You begin each chapter of the novel with an image from a particular tarot card. Why did you do that?
You know, as I got deeper into the research and writing of the story, I was struck by the similarities of not only the incidents that happened during Escrimon's life and the Albigensian Crusade, but also the philosophy, the theology, the gnosis of the Cathars, and how it seemed to be reflected in the various narratives that are set forth in the Tarot. I'll give you an example of one. There's a card called the Strength card that in most Tarot decks, it shows, say, a woman in a very strange situation where she is closing the jaws of a lion. Now, we look at that and we think, that's very bizarre. I mean, what does that mean? But to the Cathars and the Occitans of southern France, that had a very clear meaning in two respects. The leader of the Catholic army that ruthlessly persecuted the Cathars, his name was Simon de Montfort. His nickname was the Lion of the Languedoc. Hence, what this tarot image, in my opinion, depicted was, he was killed by a woman who launched a stone from a catapult during the siege of Toulouse. The stone crashed into Simon Ford's skull and killed him. Hence, the woman subduing the lion. It also has a deeper meaning in the sense that the Occitan culture, the troubadour culture of Occitania, was considered feminine. It was almost the rise of the first Renaissance before it was crushed out. And the lion represented the patriarchal church, the raw savage power that came down and crushed the feminine aspect of Christianity. So you have an overt meaning in the tarot card, and you have a deeper, more philosophical meaning. And I found in my research there were many layers that appeared like that throughout the story of the Cathars. And I should mention that about halfway through my research, I came upon the work of a biblical scholar, Margaret Starbird, who wrote a wonderful book called The Woman with the Alabaster Jar. And there she had also posited the same theory that there was a connection between the Cathars and the Tarot. We really don't know the origins of the Tarot for certain. We only know that it goes back somewhere into the myths of the 14th century, and then we kind of lose track of it. But I think as people read the book, they'll slowly draw this same conclusion that there is something there between the Cathars and the Tarot.
There's a quote in the book, "The faithful are many, but the faith is one." And that is a quote from a medieval poet. Who was the poet, and why did you include that quote?
Well, he's a lot of readers will recognize that quote, I think. It was from a famous Sufi poet named Rumi. He's quite popular today, and I don't think it's any coincidence that the popularity of the Cathars is arising at the same time that the popularity of Rumi is arising. They are connected. He is probably the Islamic version, he and his followers, Islamic versions of what the Cathars were. They both were the esoteric branch of their respective faiths. They both sought through meditation and certain esoteric practices to reach this, for lack of a better word, spiritual light with a capital L. hence the title of my book, The Fire and the Light, the fire representing the church, the light representing the gnosis of the Cathars. There's really two strands, two philosophies of faith that throughout history have competed against each other. And I think what Rumi was saying there was that we oftentimes divide ourselves in terms of orthodox religion, when in fact every religion is divided in itself between those who seek the individual quest for the truth and those who blindly accept certain doctrines and tenets that are given to them. And so it's the faithful are one, the faith is many.
Why do you think that this resurgence in popularity has taken place with Rumi's sayings and with the Cathars?
I think there's a general thirst, Ron, for people sense that they may not have been told the whole story, that there may be the alternative explanations for what actually happened in terms of the origins of Christianity and perhaps the origins of Islam as well. And what you find is this is not new. This is a trend that goes through all religions, is that the initial impetus, if you will, for what brings that religion about is often stamped out by those who take control of it. So I think people today, there's a general dissatisfaction with what they've been taught. I think the Da Vinci Code fed into that. And so the more people can find out about possible alternative explanations of why we're here, what Christ taught, for example, I think that explains the rise in popularity.
What do you think the treasure of Esclarmonde du Foix and the Cathars protected at Montsegur?
Ron, you're an excellent journalist, and you're trying to get me to give the ending away, but I'm going to I'd try the same thing if our roles were in reverse, but I hope you'll let me simply allow my readers to learn that on their own. I think they'll be surprised at what I think it is.
My guest today is Glenn Craney. It's absolutely a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you. The book is called The Fire and the Light. It should be available on bookshelves and online quite soon. Glenn, I really appreciate you taking the time.
And thank you, Ron.
I just want to say thanks once again to Glenn Craney for giving us this opportunity to speak with him. And I encourage all our listeners out there, pick up the new novel, The Fire and the Light by Glenn Craney, available online and on bookshelves right now. And as always, the Behind the Book podcast is brought to you by Greenleaf Book Group, a publisher and distributor dedicated to independent authors and small presses, on the web at greenleafbookgroup.com. And lastly, and always most importantly, I'd like to thank you for tuning in. This has been the Behind the Book podcast, and from our iPressroom studios here in West Los Angeles, I'm Ron Guerin. Until next time.